Chapter 10. Valdor entered the arming chamber. A dozen attendant serfs were waiting for him, each bearing a piece of his armour. Some articles were supported by two or more pairs of hands, given the weight of the individual Auramite segments, and all shone with a glassy, almost dazzling lustre. In the earliest days of the long campaign, even the Legio Custodes had not worn this gold. They had made do with what could be provided by the fledgling state they had been created to protect, and their weapons and protection had been almost as crude as those they had fought against. Slowly, slowly, the artifice had increased. Techrites and artisans were brought into the Sigillite's orbit and pressed into more strenuous service than they had known before. Old skills were recovered, new techniques devised. The new ceramic compounds used in protective warplate were the greatest leap forward, stronger and more heat-resistant than their metallic counterparts, and capable of being tooled with incredible precision. Motive power could be coupled effectively to the machined units, giving the wearer precise control over the level of power assistance. Many warlords on Terra employed versions of so-called power armor, but none of them had access to anything like this. So when Valdor looked at his armor now, he saw the way every component fitted perfectly against his flesh, the way every component slotted perfectly against the others. Every sinew link, every fiber bundle, every synapse jack, they were all works of art, tailored to him alone and wearable by no other soul. Once donned, the division between armor and wearer was more a matter of semantics than anything else. For all practical purposes, they became one unit, a seamless amalgam of gene-bred muscle and lab-wrought nanotechnology. At the start, even he had not fully understood the need for the ornate decoration that overlaid these symbiotic links. He would have gladly gone to war wearing the drabbest of unfinished plate, just so long as it allowed him to achieve his objectives with perfect fluency. The astrological decorations, the occult symbolism, the martial finery pulled from ancient Earth's cultural archetypes, those all came from the Emperor's dictate.
"It is not enough to conquer as others have conquered,"
Malkador had told Valdor right at the start, just after the agonies of ascension had started to fade.
"You are the heirs of our dreams. You are the bringer of the new age and the warden of the old. You are the destroyer, but also the preserver."
Over time, the lesson was learned. A custodian became more than a warrior. He became a living symbol, a marker of the Emperor's mandate on Earth. The merest glimpse of embellished Auramite was enough to quell rebellions or send enemy armies into panicked flight. Soon, the only individuals capable of even meeting the custodians in battle were those made so insane from combat stims that they barely knew what they were being killed by. Every warrior of the Order became obsessed with his armor. Over the decades, they studied every niche and crevice in it, learning the curve and sweep of each individual item. Jewels were reverently set in place, all of them standing in esoteric relation to the others. Names were carved on the inner arc of the breastplates, forming long lines, like binding rope around the beating heart within. The decoration no longer seemed superfluous, it became intrinsic. They were form and function, aesthetic and mechanic, mind and soul. The donning of it became ritualized. Pieces were moved about in the proper order, fixed with the same procedures and locked in place with the same cares and gestures. Now, as the long-promised storm flayed the palace exterior, Valdor felt the familiar clicks and flickers of his nerve interfaces sliding into position. He felt the spark of his armor's soul kindle against his own, expanding his consciousness into a shadow world of advanced perception and motion prediction. Potency flushed down his veins, augmenting the already prodigious strength fermenting there. It was alchemy, this process, neither pure engineering nor pure biomancy, but something uneasily mixed from both fountainheads. If he had been capable of arrogance, he might have revelled in the results. As it was, he had not had a single arrogant thought since the dawn of his new life state. He had never taken pleasure in his capability nor his equipment, only a kind of blunt satisfaction when an obstacle was removed or an order followed or a threat dispatched. And yet, there were half-memories, dim ones, like snuffed candles of the time before. He almost remembered what it was like to dream his own dreams, or to feel the hot spikes of jealousy, rage, or avarice. They had become intellectual constructs, those emotions, but still they were far from unintelligible. In rare moments of introspection, he found himself wondering how much he had lost in order to gain the powers he had, and whether the bargain was one he would ever have made himself, given the choice. Such thoughts did not last long. Every fibre of his being was set against them. Within moments, the obsessions would crowd in again, and he would attend to his fine armour, and attend to the mastery of his superb weapons, and attend to the condition of his already superlative body. As he did so, the old words would cycle through his mind over and over like a mantra of one of the religions he himself had helped to scour from existence. "You are the bringer of the new age. You are the warden of the old. You are the destroyer. You are the preserver." The last item was slotted into place, filament drilled and given a spike test. The final serf withdrew, bowing respectfully. Valdor, now encased in his killing garb, flexed his arms, checking the response of the Auramite's second skin. The air around him hummed with danger, the most potent expression of which was the idea, now fizzing through his neural links, that all this made him invincible. It was a lie, a malignant falsehood, but it nagged around the edges every time this battle aegis was in place and complete. "There is surely such a thing as too much power," he had said to the Emperor once. "Over-concentration in a single soul brings risks." "You do not yet know what you will be expected to face," his master had replied. "Have patience. It will not always be barbarians and petty witches who die under your blade." The serfs exited silently, shifting back into the shadows. The great Apollonian spear, once carried in war by the Emperor himself and now borne solely by his champion, hung in a silver-flecked suspensor miasma, ready to be grasped. Once Valdor's gauntlet closed on the grips, there would be no withdrawal from what had to be done. He could still experience a morsel of regret, though. That response, for some reason, had never been excised from his emotional life. "Captain General," came Simonas's voice in his cochlear bead. "Proceed," Valdor replied. "You asked for evidence. It awaits review over the grid whenever you wish." "Summarize." "Her forces have been supplied and are moving into position. They will be ready to strike within the hour." "Understood. And so I think I know what you are about to ask me." "I detained an operative working on the core sequencing program. She knows very little, but it was enough. Her testimony is recorded, should you wish to review." "I have full trust in your judgment. Tell me her name, though." "Leora Harrod, Technician Class Tertius." Valdor inclined his chin fractionally, detected a minuscule imperfection in his helm's response time. To any other soul, that would have been imperceptible. It would not impede his responses in any measurable way. It would still require remedial work once all this was over. "An Albanian name," he said thoughtfully, "with a heritage." He stirred again. "Then you have full sanction. Move now. Ensure this is done swiftly." There was a pause over the link.
"We are few in number here.
Will you join us, Captain General?
No.
Faldor reached out into the suspenser and gripped the spear.
There are multiple storms assailing us this night. You will have to extinguish this one yourself.
He started to move, and the doors to the chamber hissed open. Cold air sighed across the glass-fine auramite, though it would get much colder before all was done.
By his will, then,
Simona said, preparing to make his own movement.
By his will,
said Valdor, closing the link and briefly wondering, in an abstract sense, just when there had, for him, been anything more than that. Magister Novax Iliad walked through the doors to the inner control nexus, adjusting his starched cream tabard as he went. The lumens were too bright down here, and the projector beads flashed from the white plastic corridor walls quite uncomfortably. Everyone hated these overlit interiors, but that made no difference, for this was her domain, and the only opinion that carried any weight in here was Astarte's. The nexus itself was a strange construction, an elliptical bubble of steel and glass lodged amid this orthogonal half-city of rock-crete and masonry. Its walls were curved, its interiors shiny. Every surface was pristine, an effect safeguarded by the small armies of menials who shuffled through its innards every hour. It was always quiet in here, though the low hum of machinery never quite went away, and the air always smelled faintly of almonds. He could just about hear the storm flying against the walls outside. The narrow viewports on either side of the corridor were already blurred with the impacts of whirling snow, and there was a steady thud drum against the arched roofs. The very idea of that maelstrom made Iliad shudder. He was from tropical climes by birth, a native of the chaotic hyperconurbs of High Brasil, and this forlorn place perched at the summit of the habitable biosphere had always repelled him. Still, you went where your passion led you, and after a long and furtive career in genetic engineering during the dark times, Iliad had been led here, one of many scientists sucked up by the Emperor's voracious war machine, scooped into flyers and brought en masse to the laboratories and research stations of Unity's showpiece citadel. Iliad had been told that one day the climate here would not be quite so disagreeable. That would, of course, imply that the Emperor was capable of altering the atmosphere itself. After what he had seen since arriving 20 years ago, Iliad no longer doubted it. He reached Astarte's sanctum. He felt a hot blush of a dermal scan and a tingle across his innards as the chromosomal wash took effect. A glossy panel on the right-hand side of the doors glowed green, then the doors opened. The interior matched its mistress's Spartan personality. The chamber was circular, more than 20 meters across. Light played everywhere, from reflectors, refractors, crystal tubes, and finely channeled watercourses. The floor was white, as was the roof, and matte grey synth-leather couches ringed an open foyer. The only outside windows ran in a narrow band, bisecting the two hemispheres of roof and floor, though all were currently obscured with storm fury. This place was high up, and the hurricane outside was becoming ever more violent. Astarte was alone, just as she'd said she would be. As the doors slid closed behind him, Iliad realized that there were no servants present either, which was unusual. She normally surrounded herself with her creations, all of them subtly improved or tinkered with in some way.
"Reporting as ordered, Lord,"
Iliad said. Astarte didn't turn to face him for a moment, and so he was staring at her back for an uncomfortable amount of time. Her floor-length shift was as white and sheer as everything else here. When caught at a certain angle, the material was dazzling, generating a faint halo around her, like the angels of old Terran myth. She was so, so thin, as slender as the tower itself, a mere slip of substance amid a sea of diffuse light. That made it all the more jarring when, as she turned to face him at last, he saw again the grey flesh of her hairless head, face sunken across prominent bones, wrinkled into desiccation. Amar Astarte was the greatest mortal gene wright who had ever lived, save the one who had sponsored her, and could have easily given herself a new skin, and yet chose not to. More than that, though, was the decay she seemed to have encouraged, as if to make some kind of statement, although Iliad had never understood what that might be.
"Were you followed?" she asked.
Iliad found the question insulting. The internal transit routes from the dungeon to the Nexus were as secure as any on the planet, and he was no amateur.
"Absolutely not," he said.
Astarte nodded and padded over to a small round column. Hovering over the surface, trapped in a suspensor field, was a gently rotating crystal vial the length of a hand. She looked at it mournfully, ignoring Iliad. The vial glittered in the web of light, exposing bubbles in the milky solution within.
"Even now, after all this time, I find myself captivated by the potential we hold in these little things," she said, her soft voice as dry as her flaking scalp.
Iliad readied himself. When she was in these kinds of moods, conversation was a chore to be endured.
"Quite so," he said.
Her eyes narrowed, following the traced arc of the vial as it slowly swept around.
"Hundreds of thousands of them, each unique, each cultivated with such extreme care. And yet we could reach out, I could reach out myself here and just snap it open. How long would it last then? A few seconds? But let it mature. Then we are looking at eternity, I think."
Iliad waited for the rumination to die out.
"Constantine would have let them all burn had I not been there. I wonder if he would have been happy to do it. Had he known then what he knows now, he might have lit the taper himself. But then he was given an order, and of course Constantine cannot disobey an order. None of his kind can. That is the weakness at the heart of this empire. No one is disobeying anything."
"There must be discipline,"
Iliad ventured carefully. Astarte looked up at him, a wry half-smile darted across withered lips.
"Must there? To give us the space to do what we do? But then it becomes an end as well as a means."
She reached out a gloved finger and placed its tip into the suspensor, almost touching the vial.
"It should make us fearful, I think. All of this should make us very fearful."
The translucent field flexed and refracted around the fabric of the glove.
"The great balance, power and control, a weapon, its user. The former must not be greater than the latter. I'm sure you agree, Novax."
If Iliad had understood, he might well have agreed. As it was, he had very little idea what she was talking about. Probably best to retreat into platitudes.
"The program is on schedule. I am told that results from the proving grounds are promised."
"What did you wish for when you started this?" she asked,
removing her finger and turning to him at last.
"The gene craft, I mean. What did you intend your legacy to be? Were you entranced by the science of it, or was it the coin you were able to gather?"
Iliad hesitated.
I found I had an aptitude for it, and back then it had to be secret and in the service of the wars, so—"
"This is all still in the service of the wars, Magister,"
Astarte said gloomily.
"Things are more systematic, that is true. We have achieved more than I would ever have thought possible. They are ready. They are as perfect as we are ever likely to make them. Mass production will follow when they figure out how to achieve that, and after that no one will remember it. But we were the ones who made it all happen."
"It was the Emperor's genius."
"Very true. Not just his, though. Many minds have been involved in this from the start. There has been dispute, there has been divergence, and there has been treachery."
"Treachery?"
What did you wish to speak to me about, Magister?
Iliad blinked. It was always so hard to keep up with what she wanted. Astarte was brilliant, her speech razor-rapid, but her mind was like an accelerator tube, zinging and rebounding with particles that went off in all directions.
One of my staff is missing.
Astarte smiled.
How unfortunate. How many do you have?
1,340.
And you keep a close eye on them all?
I try to. She is a technician, Leora Harrod.
Class Tertius.
Astarte walked away from the suspenser towards a white plastic cabinet.
Yes, you know of her?
Astarte depressed a bead on the cabinet's top and a sealed tray slid noiselessly out.
She is a fine worker and has a fine mind. Finer, I should say, than her masters.
Iliad bristled but stayed the course.
She requested leave of absence for minor illness. Fatigue, she said. I gave her a period to recover herself, but she did not return to her station.
Astarte delved into the tray absently, seeking something within.
And so you, I suppose, made inquiries?
I did. She has been behaving unusually for some time, I found out. Several tracked visits to supply depots where she had no business to be. I discovered that she was seen heading towards a secure incoming facility just before she disappeared. After that, nothing. I have even begun to suspect that my investigation is being somehow frustrated from above.
Astarte laughed. The sound was surprisingly girlish from such a withered mouth.
Oh dear,
she said, retrieving what she was after and turning to face him again.
I rather think you might be right, Magister.
Iliad said nothing for a moment. He stared at the pulse pistol in his mistress's hand. It was as sleek and white as everything else in this place, no doubt made specially for her. It looked wickedly deadly.
Oh, may I?
I told you there was treachery in this palace. You have already come to the same conclusion. You have come to believe that Leora Harrod may be implicated in it. Thus you have come to see me to ensure that I am aware and can now take action.
Iliad began to get worried. Something about her voice, always unsettling, had become positively chilling.
Yes, but I...
Leora Harrod is an intelligent woman. She understands more about what has been happening here than you will ever do. No, I do not know what has happened to her yet, but yes, she is a traitor. I suspect that someone else has realized this too and has decided to intervene. And that requires a response from me as well. For, you see, she was acting on my orders. And if we are to insist on using this dreary terminology, then that makes me a traitor too.
Iliad was about to speak again, to try to get some sense out of it all, when Astarte fired. She was not a good shot, and the last pulse tore through his shoulder, throwing him back across the shining floor panels. The wave of pain nearly made him pass out, and he curled up into a tight ball, his jaw locked in agony. Astarte walked over to him calmly, still holding the pistol in front of her.
Harrod may be the first casualty, but that matters little, she said, though she is, or possibly was, a hero.
Iliad tried to speak, but it was hard to make his muscles work. He watched Astarte loom over him, pale and shining, her shift glistening like samite. Iliad managed to get his left hand to move and tried, pathetically, to block the shot. But Astarte was closer now, and even she couldn't miss. The pulse lanced straight through his heart, killing him instantly. Astarte watched his body for a moment longer. A black-red pool of blood slowly emerged from under him and expanded across the flawless plastic. Then she turned, walking aimlessly back to the cabinet. Only two commands remained to be given. The first was to the team of servitors she had waiting outside. They would clean up the mess in just a few moments. The second was to her captain-at-arms, Jalice Bodamo of the Castellan Exemplars.
"It is done," she voxed to Bodamo, putting the pistol away. "No more deception can be effective from this point. Mobilize your troops and move on the senatorum. We strike tonight."